And welcome to Read Science. And today we are speaking with two physicists who happen to be fabulous authors, very engaging and able to communicate complex topics with the general public. So for today we're going to take a look at the concept that scientists are all too human. And it's my pleasure to introduce, first of all, Michael Brooks, who has written several books, including the very wildly popular book, 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. And this one I know has sold very well. I know people know this book. They comment on this book all this time. And he tackles the big things like death and sex and silly things like homeopathy. But his latest book that I read last year that I really enjoyed quite a bit is called Free Radicals, The Secret Anarchy of Science, which takes a look at scientists, well, behaving a bit badly. And and I'll let Jeff introduce Mario, our other guest, and then I will tell my story of disillusion with scientists.
Okay.
Thanks, Joanne. I get to introduce Mario Livio, who is an astrophysicist who's been working, I read, since 1991 at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is the Center for Science Operations for the Hubble Space Telescope. It's located in Baltimore in a very beautiful spot on the campus of Johns Hopkins University and happens to be only about 20 miles from where I'm sitting right at the moment. It's a lovely spot. His first popular science book was called The Accelerating Universe, and after that came The Golden Ratio, which is the first book that I read and enjoyed immensely. Then The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, which is about group theory and proving the unsolvability of quintic algebraic equations. God is a Mathematician. Is God a Mathematician? Came next. And I read on his website that he's an avid friend of the arts, and he tends to look at science with an esthetician's eye, inviting his readers to see the beauty in math and science, and I think that's a fabulous pursuit. Here is his latest book, Brilliant Blunders, and he's telling us five stories about five famous scientists who got it wrong about something really big, and I like these stories. I like those scientists. Welcome, Mario.
My
Back
pleasure.
To you, Joanne.
Great. I'm glad to have you all here. And as we've been sort of joking here, Michael is a quantum physicist, and Mario's an astrophysicist, and Jeff is engineering physicist. Sorry, dear, if I don't know all everything about you. And I'm a biologist, but I live my life surrounded by physicists and engineers anyway.
There are worse things.
There are worse things. This is fabulous. This is great. So before we start talking about science as a human endeavor, I remember in college, I originally went there to become a physician because I didn't know what to do with science. I didn't know any scientists, so I thought, well, I'll become a physician, have a compassionate streak and everything. And but ultimately, I decided I was pretty good at educating, and I thought I would become a science educator, but to do that properly, I would need to do some research so that I could pass along the way of thinking about science and researching about science. And in graduate school, I came across some really big egos. And it just...
Surprise.
It was just such a shock to me. To me, I thought scientists were these people just pursuing things out of incredible passion and excitement, the excitement of discovery. And instead, I found people like backbiting and fighting and, just the struggle. And it blew me away. And it put me in a little bit of a depression, but then I got over it. So I'm happy to talk today about how the public views scientists and versus how they really are, and how does this advance science? And our two authors are going to be perfect for helping us discuss this. So I think my first question is, let's talk a little bit about how the general public sees scientists. And either of you are free to
I'd happily jump in on that. I think one of the most interesting things that I've ever seen was when you get the what's called the draw a scientist test. I don't know if you've come across this. But you get a load of, you know, primary school children to sort of draw a scientist. You just say, you know, draw me a scientist, and they draw this kind of white male who's balding, usually has lots of facial hair and glasses. I feel like I'm describing Jeff now.
In a lab coat,
and there's pens in the pocket of the lab coat, and it's this, you know, incredible stereotype that gets passed down. And of course, if you go into a research lab, you see all kinds of scientists. You know, you see women, you see young, you see old, you see, you know, a huge variety. And there's an enormous mismatch between our kind of cultural view of what a scientist is and who a scientist is, and the reality of it. I mean, it's not just in physical appearance. I think it's also in kind of sense of who these people are. You know, they're kind of weird, logical, rational, kind of not quite human beings. Whereas, you know, the scientists that I know and hang out with, they're kind of, you know, they're usually really good fun to be with. So I almost, you know, it was a big motivation for me in writing Free Radicals was this kind of exploring this mismatch and trying to understand what was going on with it.
So the way I would see it is, well, I agree with everything Michael said, but there is also another perception of scientists, which is, you know, the mad scientist. That's a yes. very popular view yeah. of scientists, too. You see this in books, in films, in cartoons, in, you know, there is a lot of this mad scientist type thing. The other thing, which is more related to my current book, is this notion that science progresses in this direct march mm-hmm. to the truth, when in fact nothing can be further from the truth. Science progresses in this very zigzag path, where, you know, you encounter lots of false starts. There are many blind alleys out there, and this is how progress is being made. So it's not as if, you know, scientists from day one, they know exactly the end point and, you know, they reach it on the shortest path. It is really far from that.
I read, I've managed to find an old book from the 50s called something like On Understanding Science by James Conant, who was a very well-known physicist at the time. And at that time, he was president of Harvard University. And he was making remarks in a speech about how important science education was, and he was talking about teaching at the university, but his remarks read very well for commentary on a general public understanding. And one of two or three key points, he felt that it was vitally important to teach science complete with blind alleys, mistakes, and those yeah. sorts of things. Yeah. And I think he wasn't thinking of the human thing, but he was thinking of showing it as a real process divorced from, or separate, and to separate that from this mistaken idea people have of the scientific, what do they always call it? You know, the scientific
endeavor.
Process. The method,
yeah,
the
yeah.
so-called method that they think they understand, and which is nothing about the way that, you know, science actually works or progresses.
Yeah.
And then you get the questions like, well, and I have a question we'll come to later about the way public doesn't trust scientists now, so how do you go about teaching science with the blemishes and the mistakes without being blamed or having those, you know, pronounced as grand failures and showing why science is a bad thing?
So, well, you know, one of the reasons that you want to teach all these blemishes and mistakes and so on is because if people understand that this is actually part of what progress really means in this case, you see, if you are stuck in some low point and you want to get out of that low point, incremental changes, tiny changes are not going to get you out. You have to take a risk, you know, to be able to make the breakthrough. So the idea is that, sure, you should not do sloppy science and certainly should not be careless, but you every now and then, you know, you should take a risk. And you should take a risk on a bold idea. You know, if you want, you know, people say, you know, you have to think outside the box. Well, guess what? Thinking outside the box requires taking some risks. Mm-hmm. And if you only if you take those risks, you're likely to actually hit a big discovery very often.
So do you get funded for taking risks these days, though? I think that's probably, you know, holding us back a little bit.
You're right. But you see, you can somehow improve processes like that too. Let me give you an example. On the Hubble Space Telescope, until a few years back, we used to have, you know, people apply from all over the world for time on Hubble and so on. And, you know, there is a huge ratio of proposals accepted versus submitted, you know, and so on, like 19 to 1 or something like this. And yet, the time allocation committees were encouraged to allocate as much as 10% of the time to what were deemed risky proposals. These were proposals where it wasn't absolutely sure whether the goals can be achieved, but where if the goal would have been achieved, the reward would be enormous. So you can devise processes that somehow, you know, take these things into account.
There are differences between what happens at NASA and what happens in a kind of a university academic situation where people are judged on their number of publications and things. And actually, sometimes taking a risk means a risk of not publishing and not being able to publish your results. Yeah. And that's actually, that is a big risk for young researchers, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think the older you get and the more established you get, the easier it is to take a risk.
Right. So you shouldn't do this before you get tenure, but but after you get tenure, at least, you know, you can do that.
Yeah. But how do you get tenure?
Right. Right, without making some big splash,
yeah, quite,
but
yeah.
There's a hidden culture too. I think it was understood around our lab, and if I reveal something that nobody else does, that would be awkward. But if you would get a succession of grants, and you use this grant ostensibly to perform the research that you proposed, when in fact the only way you can get that grant is to know how some of that research goes, and so in fact you already did some of that research on the previous grant. So you use the new grant to try out part of it, to try out some new ideas, maybe even some risky things to see whether there's good ground for moving into a risky area. But we also have the various government agencies have the Small Business Innovation Research Program, which is a set-aside program of a very small, 5% of their research budget. And it's been purposely set aside as a way to spend small amounts in useful ways on very risky ideas. And so they're quite willing to fund what seem like outlandish ideas because the expenditures are so small. But the payoff can be very big if it happens to work, and sometimes it does.
Right, and some of the research and development departments of some of the actually private companies also do, you know, this kind of thing, encouraging some risks.
If you can avoid falling into that austerity trap, like Bell Labs seems finally to have done, of saying, well, we need to cut back and concentrate only on practical things, you're never going to discover anything that way, are you?
Yeah. I mean, coming back from the issue of you know, the kind of practicalities of being a scientist trying to take risks, I do think there is a problem with the public not seeing when it goes wrong. That's what's so great about the concept of Mario's book. Mm-hmm. I think is let's celebrate these things. You know, when we go to an art gallery, it's just as fascinating to see the amazing finished picture as it is to see the sketches that led to that. And sometimes you see it, you know, how the artist has changed their mind about how they're going to do something. And you see this progression in the sketches that lead to this, you know, masterpiece. And I think, you know, the scientists could do with doing a bit of that as well, you know, putting out the sketches, as it were.
The negative
or the less famous pictures.
Right. Today we can even sometimes, you know, you can take x-rays or infrared images of paintings and actually see what they painted on underneath.
Yeah.
You know, and then changed completely the entire configuration.
Yeah. And that makes it much more interesting, doesn't it? It's not just a finished product. You know, you see the process of the art. And I think, you know, science is just as creative.
When Joanne and I were talking about this as a human endeavor, this science, and then the first question that comes to mind is like, well, how do we show that to the public in a safe way? The thing that came to mind is certainly the outbreak we have of anti-Scientism in this country, but the great debates about evolution versus creationism, or even worse, the big climate discussion. And the thing that bothers me as a scientist the most, I think, is that in order to make any political gains in discussion about climate change, scientists are forced to make absolute pronouncements and say, we are definitely changing, we are definitely this, it's definitely caused by, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as political statements that makes them very, very uncomfortable as scientists, because we're accustomed to contingent truth and anything can change. But that's not going to fly on this political stage. How do we keep from getting forced into that sort of pronouncement, or how do we reveal, you know, talk honestly about blunders, mistakes, but as part of a, you know, as a positive part of the process, without making it look like weaknesses and things. And that's the conundrum for me when we were talking about this.
Yeah, and I'll just pop in, not just political statements, but if you're on the news or on a TV show or something, they want a soundbite where you sound 100% positive. This is the research encapsulated in 30 seconds. And so I believe both of you have experience with that, communicating this. But yeah, you know, most of us as scientists will say, well, you know, and we want to sort of, but on this hand and this hand, and couch it gently and, you know, without that. So definitely, I like where you're going with that, Jeff.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, when people make political statements, or even, you're right, just appear on a TV show or something like this, things have to kind of be black or white. All this nuanced science, you know, that we are so used to, and expressing doubt is somehow interpreted as a weakness. Mm-hmm. When in fact science in some sense is all about doubt. I mean, Bertrand Russell once said, you know, never be absolutely certain about anything. You know, he gave that as one of his commandments. I mean, he wanted to avoid fanaticism and so on, but it applies really to almost everything, you know. I mean, you should never be absolutely certain, you know, about anything.
There are all these fantastic quotes from people. I can't remember the name of the guy now. It was an astronomer sort of in the late 1800s who said, you know, I think we know pretty much all we're ever going to know about astronomy and the universe. You know, and 10 years later, Einstein came along and changed everything. So
yeah, this was Lord Kelvin, actually, who was one of the heroes of my book.
Yeah. Lord, the Kelvin story, I haven't gone to that part yet in the book, Mario, but when I saw Kelvin there, I thought, great, because this is one of my favorite stories, and whenever I hear someone, and he goes so well with Darwin, the picture that Darwin says, well, I know that natural selection is a valid process, but it's going to take more time than there appears to have been, because Kelvin is over here saying, well, there's just not enough time, the Earth can't be that old, and then in my mind, I hear him say, based on what we know, and, you know, in a conversation, that comes to mind whenever I hear people say, doesn't violate any known laws of physics. And I think, aha, but there can be unknown laws of physics that change the whole picture. And I love that story because it's such a turning point.
Right, and sometimes even you don't need a new law of physics,
yes.
but just a process you didn't think about, you know, within the existing laws of physics.
Yeah.
So this sounds like the foundational work that needs to be done is, you know, as this is Joanne and I, when we're doing our outreach public education thing, is about science process, about blunders and mistakes, and how science progresses, and that it's not like the great ladder of evolution that leads up and up to humans, but is a process that ends someplace, and that it's wasn't it Carl Sagan? No, it was Richard Feynman who says, you know, science speaks of science as the process, who says it's the best way we know to keep from fooling ourselves.
Yeah.
And he doesn't
say
it's perfect. He doesn't, you know, pronounce, he just says he thinks it's the best way to avoid some of the, you know, more of those missteps, but there's still going to be some.
Right.
It's interesting, Jeff, you say that about evolution, because, of course, evolution isn't a matter of progress towards a goal either. Evolution, again, in our kind of cultural conception of it, we think of it as always progress towards, towards man, towards sort of this pinnacle of evolution. But of course, evolution is just going haphazardly all over the place.
Well, and that misconception is almost as hard to fight back as the mad scientist in the white lab coat. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know how those images persist.
But I think there's a lot of cultural work to do here. You know, I think politicians are actually starting to appreciate that scientists can't be certain about things. And certainly in the UK, there is more of a move towards politicians and civil servants, their advisors, being able to handle doubt and being able to handle probabilities and risk assessments and that kind of thing. And I think we are slowly changing the culture. And I think that's going to take a long time to trickle down to kind of everybody perceiving science as being, something that's tentative. I mean, science always reserves the right to change its mind about anything that it says. But we do make discoveries that and then we move forward. But some things, then move backwards. And I think, the more people hear about science and the more people interact with science, the more they'll get that. I think it just, the trouble is for all of us who are trained in science, it's just part of the blood now. We kind of know this how it is. So even if somebody makes the mistake of saying, this is definitely, what I found, we all know that the subtext is there, that actually, given, the constraints of experiments and everything else. And I think people, in the UK, I think we're getting more and more in touch with science now. And people are engaging with science, and I think there is a sense that people are more forgiving towards scientists. If they see something, as sort of switched around, or people sort of backtrack over certain research results. The trouble is, media reporting sometimes can make it look like things were far more certain than they ever were.
On one hand, there is that, and on the other, there is that. The fact is that in the media, stories sell much better if they involve some sort of superlative. So, every discovery has to be the most, the strongest, the highest, the most distant. So, for example, in astronomy, we continuously discover the most distant galaxy ever discovered. And also there is, in order to make this more of a story, the other thing is that, the story goes very often like this: scientists dumbfounded yet again, which makes us look like a bunch of idiots, because all the time we are being so astonished at the results.
Confounded.
The results really were not that surprising,
Yeah.
Controversy helps sell things a lot too. Various dumbfounding sorts of discoveries.
Right.
I think it's been really interesting. Last year or the year before it was now, with the neutrinos that were going faster than light, and how we had such an enormous fuss made about it, and everybody on the inside pretty much knew that result was wrong. If you're a physicist, you pretty much knew that result was wrong. You were just waiting for them to find what they'd done wrong, I think the overall impression of it was that, it engaged people with, they'd never heard of neutrinos, they'd never come across this kind of whole zoo of subatomic particles. And I think the net effect was really positive, even if somebody did have to kind of, lose their job over it in the end.
There were two stories interesting about that thing. One was this Italian minister who said that she thought that this was fantastic, that they managed to dig this tunnel from Switzerland to Italy for the neutrinos to travel in. This was one story. The other was that I gave one interview on the radio where I said, just plain, like I said, that if this will turn out to be true, I'm going to eat my hat. And this is a very strong statement because I don't own a hat. So I actually promised to buy a hat and eat it if it turns out to be true.
So, this brings up a good point. The cold fusion, arsenic bacteria, where we're just too quick to get the attention, concerning a possible breakthrough, because the cold fusion thing ended up being interesting thing that played out in America.
I was there for that, but
you were there.
This is something that we were talking about, Joanne, and bears on you know, is this telling us that indeed there are at least a fair number of people, if not everyone, who are keenly interested in science and would like to know more, but are sort of out there someplace and can't quite get there to find out that, you know, there's some market for these stories, and what's going on here?
Well, you know, the fact is that, you know, there has been all this discussion, you know, about the second culture, third culture, and so on. And there is a third culture in a way. You know, what Michael and I are trying to do is part of that third culture, where we are actually trying to communicate the results of science and the way science works, you know, to a wider audience and so on. And I think that there is interest in that at some level. Unfortunately, there is, in recent years, I almost see the emergence of a fourth culture, which is a culture that maybe doesn't read at all. Neither
have
about
you met my children
or anything else. You know, I don't mind if my book is read as an e-book or as a paper book or, you know, in any shape or form, but there is somewhat of a danger that I see of people stopping to read altogether in any form. And I think that, you know, okay, maybe it's the every generation is probably lamenting about something. And maybe that's the lament of ours, but it certainly looks this way, as if, you know, in this era of expedience and so on, you know, and sound bites and so on, we are actually losing something.
Yeah, well, this is, of course, why Jeff and I, you know, sort of have our thing, Read Science. We even ran a contest called Kids Read Science, and you know, of course, I know, and you guys all know, being in science, it's like you cannot do science unless you read. And that attention span you can cultivate from reading a book and following it all the way through is so important. You know, we're just getting down to issues of general literacy, not just science literacy.
That's true.
There is going to be a bit of a cascade, right? Well, we talk about things and someone listens, that reaches someone. If someone reads Mario's or Michael's books and are excited by it, they're going to talk to some friends about it and say, I read these books and there's this idea, and it's going to spread a little bit. And that's got to be valuable. And so Mario was talking about teaching process, and I, you know, the nonprofit company that I started, and you have to write visions and things. And I decided I didn't want to educate science facts so much as I thought there was a deficiency in understanding how science worked, and that left people without tools to understand the results of science. So I wouldn't mind an endorsement of the idea of how valuable it is that we understand science as a process in order for average people to understand that, so that then they have a framework for absorbing and synthesizing science facts in a more natural way.
For me, the most important thing is critical thinking. I mean, that's all science is, is kind of looking at some evidence and kind of, you know, trying out a few hypotheses. You know, does it fit with this? Does it fit with that? It's kind of weighing things up. It's no different to, in some ways, what you do in a courtroom. So I think science isn't this separate culture of you know, understanding things through a particular way. It's just what human beings do. You know, we just happen to do it when we do it in the sphere of the natural world, we call it science, you know, but you do it in a courtroom and it's called, you know, the trial. And it's the same kind of thing. And I think that that if we can develop this sort of sense of critical thinking and keep that going, that's absolutely essential to our future, really, as a species, I would say. You know, facing things like climate change, you know, we need critical thinkers. We need creative thinkers as well. You know, the kids who are in school now are going to have to solve these issues because our generation has left it too late to do anything, you know, about it. And if we don't have those kinds of thinkers, whether they're scientists or whether you call them something else, you know, I think we're going to lose something really valuable.
I completely agree with you, and I would add two things to what you just said. I agree with every word. One is I would add curiosity. I think curiosity is absolutely essential. Yes, you have to be curious, you know, and it doesn't matter even so much if you're curious about science or this or that and so on. as long as you're curious, you're willing to learn, you know, and so on. So that's one thing. The other thing is that indeed, as you pointed out, not everybody has to be a scientist. God forbid that everybody would be an astrophysicist,
Amen.
But people need to understand science as a part of human culture learn to appreciate science and understand what this is all about, so that if they have to make decisions that are related to science, even if they are not scientists, they actually can use that critical thinking and this knowledge that they have acquired about science to make those decisions.
Yeah, you take the words right out of my mouth, but in a much better order than I usually get them.
Well, I was going to say, now we just put this in a little box and ship it to everybody, because this encapsulates.
Well, we've got work to do.
Yes.
There's a lot of work to do.
You remind me that I have a question that keeps coming up when I'm talking to people. We're talking about writing books for non-scientists and things, and I'm interested in the question. It seemed to me, and maybe I changed, but maybe it's writers who changed. It seemed to me when I was younger that the thrust of science books that I checked out at the library was to explain science and to show science facts. And the books that I enjoy now and I think are more successful are the ones like you write, is to tell stories about science that reveal science facts, but reveal process, reveal humans doing science, reveal a bigger picture in a more engaging way, perhaps, than to people who just like to read the results. Is that a real change? Is that what's going on? Is that an evolution for the better?
I would say you've got some bias in your observations there, probably, because maybe what you're interested in has changed. But you know, when I was writing Free Radicals, one of the people that I read a lot was Peter Medawar, the geneticist.
Oh yeah,
he all through his career wrote books about the processes of science, and you know, his book Advice to a Young Scientist is just superb.
Brilliant.
I'd recommend anybody to read that. So those books have always been there, and James Watson's The Double Helix as well is a book about the processes of science, you know, that led to the discovery of the structure of DNA, and that is, you know, warts and all, very much so. It's really quite eye opening.
That's right. I think what has changed, one thing that has changed, and maybe this is reflected also in your biases, Jeff, is that certainly there are more people actually who write popular science today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, early in the 20th century, you know, you had somebody like Eddington, you know, or Hoyle, who wrote some popular science books in astronomy, but there were very few. I mean, now, you know, you have many people who write, and so they encompass a wider range of topics and approaches, you know, and so on. I think there are still today the books of the types that you describe that, you know, give you facts and so on, but there is also indeed perhaps a little bit more storytelling, you know, the lives of the scientists. Michael is very right. I mean, you know, Jim Watson's book, whom by the way, I just met this past weekend in New York, and he is also one of the characters in Brilliant Blunders, who appears there, his book was a perfect example of a book that you know, described all sides of science, you know, I mean, all the envy and the competitiveness and all that sort of thing and so on. I mean, at some level, he was also criticized for some of that, because some people thought that he didn't describe the situation well. He described it with his own biases. Let's put it this way. And of course, that's true for anybody who writes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'd like to ask, both of you, but I'd like to start with Michael. Just you told many stories in Free Radicals of scientists who did drugs, scientists who get promoted a little more in the media, more attention, because they're more willing to go out and be promoted. You know. So you've got all different ways that scientists, so-called, behave badly. What was your favorite story among all of those?
Do you know what? My favorite story is really easy. It's Werner Forssmann, the guy who did the first catheterization of the human heart, because he just wasn't allowed to do it. He was told not to do it by his boss. He got access to the equipment he needed by effectively seducing the chief nurse of the hospital that he was in. And then he sort of went on and did this procedure on himself, which is now a classic kind of way of making a breakthrough that you're not really supposed to make. So he catheterized himself. He ended up in a fight with the x-ray technician to get the x-ray picture taken, and had to kick his shins to kind of get him to allow him to take the picture. And then when they published this data, the boss of the hospital said, well, you can't tell the truth about how you did it. You know, we're going to have to lie about how you actually got this picture. And so for me, that story kind of encompasses everything that a scientist is willing to do in order to get to that breakthrough, you know. And of course, this isn't true. You know, you could caricature this as being, you know, this is how science works. This is extraordinary science. This is, you know, Nobel Prize winning science. So he won a Nobel Prize having done all these terrible things. But actually, you know, there are some scientists who are these kinds of, you know, special forces kinds of soldiers. You know, they kind of go over, you know, over enemy lines, and they go into this territory. And there are others who, you know, who are staying behind and doing the supply work, which is just as necessary. You know, I had a conversation with Paul Nurse, the president of the Royal Society in the UK, and he thinks of himself more as a kind of bold adventurer who's willing to kind of, you know, go over the territory and into enemy territory, as it were. But he said he makes an awful mess, and he needs a load of people working with him to clean this up before they've got any decent science at all. And I think it's this sense of, you know, there are lots of different types of scientists that's really important to get across. You know, some are very careful and meticulous. Some are exactly, you know, the kinds of scientists that the primary school children will portray in their drawings. And others are really, you know, incredible characters like Feynman, Carl Sagan, you know, who was willing to go and get himself arrested at a nuclear test site in order to make a point, you know. So, I, you know, we have this broad spectrum, and sadly, I think the public doesn't appreciate, you know, the kind of variety that there is in the scientific kind of community. Sorry, that was a very long answer to a very simple question.
Great. Nope, so, Mario, do you have any favorite characters in science or favorite story along those lines?
Well, I have many favorite characters in science, but you know, to go back to the particular book we're discussing now, I mean, so I've chosen five characters, and these five I've chosen for several reasons. One is that they are really all luminaries. I mean, these are names, you know, that everybody knows, and so on, in order to show that even these giants, you know, have made some serious blunders. However, if you look at the different blunders, they are not all the same. I mean, you know, in the case of Darwin, okay, he misunderstood something. You know, he didn't understand that a particular, what he knew about the way genetics works really could not have worked for natural selection. So this is one type of blunder. In the case of Linus Pauling, it was, you know, to a large extent hubris. I mean, he was so successful with his model for proteins that he thought, oh, well, then I can, you know, do a model for DNA in 1 month, even though his model for proteins took him 13 years to publish. So it's a completely different. In Einstein's case, you know, he's one of those guys who thinks that he knows elegance once he sees it. And even the great Einstein didn't get it, that the elegance has to be in the principles, not in the form of the equation. So for every one of them, there is, you know, a somewhat different story. The nice thing about this is, that's another reason why I chose this particular five, that they all fit into the story of evolution. Evolution of life on Earth, evolution of the Earth itself, evolution of stars, and evolution of the universe as a whole. So these five people, you know, kind of make that story, if you like.
He's still not giving you an answer, by the way.
That's all right. he doesn't have a favorite. He doesn't play favorites.
No, I don't have a real favorite. Well, you know, if you really push me, then probably Einstein and Newton would be my favorites.
Newton was a character.
Newton was definitely a character, and he was an annoying character in that he was one of these truly annoying people that, you know, other than everything he did in alchemy, if you just look at what he did in pure physics, this guy just made no mistakes. It is horrible.
Okay, Joanne and Michael, I think you have to reveal now. Now that you've started, Joanne, you have to mention at least two of your favorites.
Two? Oh, come on. You're upping
the ante. One, if you prefer.
Well, you know what? I always laugh, and this is me being a biologist who has used PCR, and who founded the concept of PCR, and that was Carrie Mullis, right? And he is known for using mind-altering drugs. And this blows me away, because then again, I also had that sense that, oh, scientists, you know, have this purity of their lives where, you know, you wouldn't use drugs, you would have, you know what I mean, so your thinking is clear. But, you know, it seems the opposite. There are plenty of scientists who've used mind-altering drugs, including famous Carl Sagan. And so the story of Carrie Mullis is, you know, this idea just came to him. I don't know whether it was under the influence of drugs or not. But
no, it wasn't. No.
Yeah. See, I think that one was clear. And it also came before he had his supposed experience with an extraterrestrial, right?
Yes.
And I always thought the story would be more interesting if he had had that experience with the extraterrestrial who imparted this information to him. He had this idea, and you know, how can we extend just little bits of DNA over and over again, like a copy machine? And of course, it's along with the green fluorescent protein, those two things are two of the greatest things that have happened to a biologist's life, a molecular biologist's life, you know, since, you know, sliced bread, which may or may not have anything to do with biology, but using that metaphor. So Carrie Mullis, that story has always just intrigued me. Like I said, it would be more interesting if it was before after the extraterrestrial experience, but it didn't work out like it. But Michael does bring that up in his book. You have a few others you have about the drugs.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things, I always get accused of you know, encouraging people to take drugs. And I'm just going to say now, that's not what I'm doing. But one of the interesting things is Carl Sagan, you know, was well known for smoking marijuana. And he always sort of said that it would try and, you know, he would do this in order to try and help him with his work. And there's actually no evidence at all that it did help him with his work in any way. And he kind of deluded himself in lots of ways. You know, he used to make these recordings at night when he was high, saying to himself, because he knew that when he was, you know, normal in the morning, he wouldn't believe a word that would, you know, that he thought he'd done. And so he used to make tape recordings. He said, "Listen, you son of a bitch of the morning, this stuff is real." And of course, it was never any help to him at all. Apparently, it improved his appreciation of potatoes. I think it's important to say that, you know, there are, again, these exceptional cases, you know, as with Carrie Mullis. And a lot of scientists do admit to using certainly attention-enhancing drugs now, just because I think of the pressures of the work that they do. So there's a lot using things like, was it modafinil, Ritalin, that kind of thing. And there's surveys, you know, done by Nature, the journal that kind of back this up. But generally, you know, Mullis is a great story, and it's an extraordinary example of somebody who sort of, you know, deliberately set out to kind of train his brain to think visually. But and I think that's what, you know, his use of LSD really did. But interestingly, you know, Francis Crick, I'm sure Mario will back this up, Francis Crick was a very good visual thinker, and a lot of his success came from the fact that he was naturally able to, you know, visualize things, you know, that were abstract.
And so is Roger Penrose, by the way. Roger Penrose has an intuitive vision of geometry in many dimensions that I've not seen anybody else has it to that kind of a degree.
Yeah. Well, the triangle on the front of my book, 13 Things, is a Penrose triangle.
Right, right.
Wrong one.
Sorry.
Has anything to do with Roger Penrose.
Yeah.
It didn't.
But so this is a Penrose triangle, and I said to him, well, one time I was meeting him, and I said, "Oh, you know, do you mind the fact that I and everybody else have just used this whenever we feel like it?" And he says, "No, not at all." And he has this kind of sense of no proprietary belonging over his creations. You know, he came up with that staircase in that famous Escher drawing, and just kind of gave it away. And he's an extraordinary sort of, like you say, it must be some kind of thing in his, something in his brain does things.
Yeah, he truly has a perception of geometry like no other.
So now I guess it's Jeff's turn.
Well, no, and I was just thinking, I had one little thought when you were talking about Penrose saying, I don't mind if you use this. And I'm thinking, well, can we generalize this and say that, you know, great minds making great discoveries don't feel proprietary because they don't feel like these are their ideas. They feel like they've been visited or have the good fortune to notice these things. And here they are, but they're universal phenomena. They belong to the world.
Yeah, but you know, you still have people, you know, fighting for priority and all that, yeah. And so on discoveries.
You got to publish it first.
There is one great story that actually appears in my book about cosmologist Georges Lemaître, the Belgian, mm-hmm. and Edwin Hubble. And this was caused a huge debate all over the internet about 2 years ago, because Georges Lemaître in 1927 wrote an article where he talked about the expansion of the universe, and he even in an approximate way derived the Hubble law and mm-hmm. so on. That paper was published in French and nobody read it. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble published his work about, you know, the expansion of the universe, and everybody did read it. Then in 1931, the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society asked Lemaître, could they publish his French paper in English, a translation? Mm-hmm. And they did. However, certain paragraphs from that paper have been omitted. And nobody knew who omitted those paragraphs or why. And there was a huge debate that maybe Edwin Hubble had a hand in this, and he censored those to keep the priority. So actually, as part of the research for Brilliant Blunders, I went to the Royal Astronomical Society in London, and I went through their entire correspondence from those years, from 1929 to 1931, and I discovered one letter that Lemaître wrote to the editor of the monthly notices explaining that he edited, he did the translation of his own paper, and he edited out those paragraphs because since then Hubble has published better data and there was no need for those more tentative paragraphs in there. So Lemaître was definitely one of those people who thought, oh well, you know, if the data are there, I don't need to get, you know, the priority for this and so on.
Michael has some stories in his the Free Radicals about, you know, just general shenanigans like that.
Yeah, there are egos, aren't there? You know, Hubble was well known to be quite a good showman, and I think, you know, quite an ego, and very good at living the kind of scientist celebrity kind of life. But you know, you'll equally get very quiet people. Vesto Slipher was another astronomer who made massive contributions very early on to Hubble's work, but never really fought for any contribution. And there's a
Hubble
sly.
Hubble didn't even cite him.
No. There's a sly in one of Stephen Hawking's books. I can't remember which one. He mentions in a sidebar that Hubble was stood in the room at the, I think it was the American Astronomical Society meeting, where Vesto Slipher presented his results that showed, you know, the galaxies were receding. And he kind of stood at the back and just then walked away quietly. So I think Hubble was probably very good at taking other people's data and you know, running with it. Not saying he stole it, but he ran with it, certainly.
Yeah, no, he actually, in his paper, he used, you know, the data for the redshifts for 41 galaxies from Slipher without ever giving reference to his work.
Yeah. That's not unusual in science, though, is it? Once you're senior and established, you know, you don't need to give credit in the same way that you know, that you feel you do when you're younger.
It happens less now, I think. People are a little bit more sensitive to this. There was the Jocelyn Bell story, you know, and so on, which generated a lot of bad reactions. So people, even the Nobel Committee, is trying to be more careful now.
Well, it is a human endeavor, is what we're talking about, and all of these things go into it. And maybe the good moral of the story is that nevertheless, science gets done and progress gets made and understanding increases.
Yeah, it does. Science kind of stands independent in some ways of all these human issues. Yeah, and that people will always be curious, and people will always be doing science, and they'll always be, advancing things. But there'll be certain people who come to the fore who maybe, shouldn't be there, and there'll be other people in the background who you think, actually deserve more credit than they get. But I think it was ever thus. And again, this isn't just science. This is probably true in all kinds of areas of creativity. There are some people who like to just get on with it and don't really care what happens with the end result, and there are other people who like to kind of take the glory. That's human. It's just being human, isn't
right.
it?
Right.
That leads with maybe a last question. It's like, has this process that we call science, this way that we try to go about gaining new knowledge without fooling ourselves too much, it's been evolving as well, too. Have we been making improvements in the process or just changing it? But it's certainly been changing, hasn't it?
Yeah, there is no question about this. I mean, look, we are answering now questions that 100 years ago we didn't even know how to ask. The fact that we can now think that with some degree of conviction we can describe what the universe was doing when it was 10 to the minus 32 seconds old is just astounding when you think of it. Or, the way life sciences have evolved. Or our understanding of the brain. Now, this is not to say that, there isn't a lot to still do. Yes, of course, the origin of life is still not clear, and how the brain operates is really not clear at all. But we know so much more than, we knew before. I mentioned curiosity before, and you mentioned it now, and Michael mentioned, curiosity. Well, guess what? We can now take people, stick them into a functional MRI machine, and see what happens in their brains when they are curious. This is something that's amazing, that we couldn't do. So there is no question that the science itself, the way we ask the questions, the fact that, that science is empirical, that, we need to make observations and experiments. I mean, this was not always the case. Yeah, there is a story, that Aristotle, the great Aristotle, he was not empirical at all. He, for example, at one point thought that women have a different number of teeth than men. Now, Aristotle was married, and it has never occurred to him that he could count the teeth in his wife's mouth, and check this hypothesis. So there is no question that science has changed and will continue to change.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the progress in neuroscience over the last century has just been extraordinary. And I was looking at something the other day. Freud, when he started out with psychoanalysis, was hoping to be able to connect it scientifically. So he was hoping to be able to say, everything that's going on in our emotions and our feelings must have a physical correlate in the brain. But he abandoned the whole idea very, very quickly, because people just had no idea about the brain, how it worked, what was anything going on inside of it. And now, as Mario says, we can image the brain and we can see what happens when people are excited or scared, when they're curious. We can do extraordinary things. And we're a long way from finishing. I'm sure that we know very little, in fact, relatively speaking, about how the brain works. Compared to how much there is to know, but there's no doubt that we're making progress. Physics has made enormous progress, and we're also learning how to temper our progress. We're learning that there are things that we can do but maybe don't want to do, which is an important part of science. And I think when you look at some of what's happening in biology now, people are being, I think, generally really quite cautious, but we have these amazing abilities, and I think we're right to be cautious about certain aspects of synthetic biology, what we do. But I am really impressed by the progress that's being made and the ethics that's going along with it. One of the things about free radicals was that I writing that book kind of made me fall back in love with science. You know, as a science writer, I'd just been doing the kind of facts and, you know, writing this story or the feature about this or something about that, and it kind of becomes very workaday. When you start to look at what scientists do and how they do it and what pressures they're under, and then the fact that some of them, you know, some of them go off the rails, but most are making very good ethical decisions about how we use science and how it should be applied. And I think that's progress as well.
Before we wrap it up, that's a subtle way, but of mentioning that, but maybe I've been waiting for several of these sessions to use my one standard question of, do you have a question, either of you, both of you, that you've been waiting for someone to ask you and that never gets asked? Here's your chance to answer.
I don't.
No, okay, I don't either. I don't.
I'm always asked which is my favorite story.
I'm fine. Yeah. Well, there is one question that I've been asked with this book quite a bit, but I'm not waiting to be asked that question, which is, have you done any brilliant blunder? You know, they're asking me. And I like to say that I've done quite a number of blunders, but I don't know that any one of them was really brilliant.
We'll leave it for posterity, perhaps, to decide.
Well, I was going to say, time will tell, and yeah, all of us have these blunders that someone will discover, you know, 50, 100 years from now. Oh, what they did, that was actually brilliant. So, gentlemen, thank you so much. This is a great discussion, and fantastic that you joined in and shared with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thanks, both of you, very much.
Thank you.
And we'll say goodbye to you guys. Have you hang up, and Jeff and I are going to then wrap it up.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye,
then.
Michael and Mario, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. So, wow, that was great, wasn't it, Jeff?
Time has flown by again.
It definitely. So just as a reminder, it's tomorrow, right? Is it tomorrow we have Lucy Cook or Friday?
We are talking to Lucy Cook tomorrow about frogs and sloths.
Now, Lucy Cook is she's a TV producer, but many of you may know her, and if you follow me and my sort of fanaticism of her sloths, she has one of the most viral videos about sloths, but she's created TV shows not only about sloths, but about unsung animals. And this woman has studied with Richard Dawkins, so I'm interested in exploring that a little more. She's written a little book called Little Book of Sloth, and she is also working on an app, so bringing all of our read science into the modern day. However you get your science is good with us, isn't it, Jeff?
any way will work.
That's right. And looking to next week, we have photographer Susie Esterhaus, who has an amazing series of wildlife books talking about baby animals and families and using her incredible skills as a photographer. And also, excitingly, we also have Buzz Aldrin on the docket, right?
Next Wednesday, a week from today.
Yeah, so we're busy for a few weeks here. And now it looks like we'll take a break, and we'll start up in July with lots more to come.
Lots more science to talk about, lots more science to read about.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us, and we will see you again. Is it tomorrow or Friday?
Tomorrow.
All right. Well, okay, Jeff, once again, pleasure to work with you.
Thank you. Goodbye, Joanna.